Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Tonight, the Movie Geeks chat with Anthony Artis, whose new book, The Shut Up and Shoot Documentary Guide, is a must-read for all amateur filmmakers. Plus, from the highly acclaimed and controversial new horror film, The Girl Next Door, director Gregory Wilson, and screenwriters Daniel Farrens and Philip Nutman. Then, we give you the rundown on the latest DVD releases, including Hot Rod and I Am Cuba. Are you ready to get your geek on? Here are your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie and Jerry.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. We are thrilled to bring you the show tonight. It's going to be a great one tonight. My name is Jamie, and here with us is co-host Jerry.
Hey, how's everyone doing?
Jerry, you're still a little bit under the weather tonight?
I'm very much under the weather. I can't seem to kick this thing.
I'm sorry, man.
That's all right. Well, I'm going to get through this. Don't worry.
I know that a lot of people are expecting, if they didn't get our announcements in the middle of the week, Marcus Nussbaum was scheduled to participate in tonight's broadcast to give us the hot advanced scoop on his Friday the 13th remake. And so we're all very excited about that. But we received an email from his assistant during the week that said that he's still sorting out some contractual stuff on Friday the 13th, and he wanted to hold out just a little bit until he speaks openly about the film. But in the next week or so, we're going to get back in touch with Marcus and bring him on, because that is going to be a dynamite show. And
yes,
a lot of people are interested in Friday the 13th and his plans for it. So that's going to be great. A couple of notes at the top of the show here. You can subscribe to our show through iTunes. Just search for Movie Geeks United on your iTunes engine, and we'll pop up all of our past archive shows, including our tributes to Al Pacino and David Lynch and Brian De Palma, and our interview of Brian De Palma and other folks like Joe Pantoliano and Oscar-winning composer Howard Shore and Mark Isham, and on and on and on. You'll be able to get all of those shows absolutely free, and automatically downloaded onto your system will be all of our future shows as well if you're not able to listen in live. And we've got some doozies coming up. We've got this Wednesday we have character actor Raymond J. Barry. And this is a fantastic actor.
Yes, definitely.
Dead Man Walking, Born in the Fourth, Year of the Dragon. He's in the new comedy, Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story, which
that's going to be good.
That looks hysterical.
Yeah.
It's from the producing team behind 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up, and it looks really good. And then the second half of Wednesday's show will be The Water Horse, Legend of the Deep, which is a family movie that comes out Christmas Day. It's going to be a huge movie.
Yes.
The director of that, Jay Russell, and the star, Ben Chaplin. So a huge Wednesday night show. Next Sunday, we have the founders of Palm Star Entertainment, Stephen Paternot and Kevin Frakes. Very interesting story that they have, how they've started up their own film company, and they've already procured rights to a couple of high-profile projects, including Down and Dirty Pictures.
I saw that.
Yeah, the Peter Biskind, wasn't it? It was about the independent film movement led by Miramax, you know, that came about in the early 90s, late.
Yeah, it's about like Sundance and Miramax. It has all that. And
yeah, they're making that into a feature, which is interesting.
That's going to be very curious how they're going to be able to do that.
We're going to find out.
Yeah.
And then The Writer's Journey, author Chris Vogler. And this is like a book of it. In its third edition, it's helped so many writers out there. And he'll be shedding some light on his process and his books on that journey. Also, next Wednesday, actor Ernie Hudson, who most people will recognize as a Ghostbuster.
That's right.
And he has a new movie out called Everything's Jake. That looks very good. And the writer, director, and star of a new film called The Prodigy, which is a new film that's flying off the shelves. And Stanley Nelson, the director of the documentary Jonestown, The Rise and Fall of People's Temple. And that's next Wednesday. So great lineup of shows.
Yeah, no, these are wonderful lineup for the month.
Yes.
Great.
I think, are we all set to go?
Yeah, we're all set.
Okay, Jerry is manning the chat room this evening. If you have any questions you'd like to submit through the chat room and you're too shy to call in and speak on the air, we understand that. Just go ahead and do that, and Jerry will alert us to your question. Okay, let's get started. Anthony Artis is here with us tonight. Over the years, he's worked tirelessly to hone his skills as a digital guerrilla filmmaker. In the process, he's worked professionally in virtually every film crew position, from producer to gaffer to cinematographer. His feature films and TV shows have screened at some of the most prestigious venues in the world, including the Tribeca Film Festival, the IFP Market, Slam Dance, Cinequest, and the Independent Film Channel. Now, Mr. Artis has applied his wealth of knowledge and insight into his new book, The Shut Up and Shoot Documentary Guide, written in a plain-spoken, fun, and easily digestible language and featuring beautifully structured content and eye-popping full-color illustrations. This is a must-own book for any independent filmmaker, whether they work in documentaries or narrative features. British Film Magazine hails the book as a luxury presentation that makes you feel like a successful filmmaker, or that you soon will be, from the word go. It is our great pleasure to welcome filmmaker, educator, and author Anthony Artis to our show. Anthony, are you with us?
Hey, I'm with you guys. Wow, thank you so much for that introduction. I want to meet that guy.
Well, thank you for joining us tonight. Your book is wonderful. It's a fantastic book. I can't wait to talk to you about it. But first, tell me a little bit about your background in filmmaking.
Well, my background in filmmaking, you kind of summed it up there. I've kind of been everywhere. Started off mainly, probably have a heavier background in TV, and kind of slid back and forth between TV and filmmaking, but mostly started off in TV, doing kids TV locally in Baltimore, as well as doing some reality TV, a little show on MTV called Flipped, where they used to take two people and switch some places for a day. I was a second producer on that. A while back, did a little film called Shelter, that won the 2003 IFP Market Award, which is their big top prize. Also premiered at Slam Dance. A couple of other little things, Paper Chasers, with associate producer on that, which is a documentary about hip-hop entrepreneurs that premiered at Tribeca also in 2003. And since then, pretty much just been working on this book and training students at NYU.
Absolutely. So in the very beginning, when you were first turned on by film, what were the kind of movies that inspired you, and were documentaries a major part of that?
Documentaries always were. I mean, it's weird. I was into documentaries without realizing I was into documentaries, meaning I never said, hey, let me go watch a documentary. I'd usually be flipping channels on TV and just get sucked into something, and next thing I know, I'm sitting there for an hour and a half, 2 hours, completely absorbed in this, but... Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, I never really considered myself a documentary fan, although I didn't realize that I was at the time. So looking on early stuff, I would say things like Scared Straight was probably the first documentary that I ever saw, and I saw that when I was 9 years old as a kid, and I actually talk about that in the book because it literally scared the hell out of me. It was the first time I realized that, wow, films can really affect your life. It wasn't until I was much older and looked at how that documentary affected me, just in terms of main reason I think I stayed out of trouble with the law over the years is because of that documentary. Have you guys ever seen that?
Oh yeah. That's one of those vital documentaries that I think has changed a lot of lives over the years.
Yeah, well, it did for me.
Yeah,
that was one of the first ones. But in terms of movies I like, I'm probably not your typical film fan. You know, I can't sit around and cite, you know, Godot and all these other, the masters of film. I like films like Scarface.
Oh, yeah.
And Friday the 13th. I grew up with all of that kind of stuff, and I think there's still a place for, you know, entertainment, Pulp Fiction. You know, I grew up on Tarantino and a lot of the modern
masters,
as well as, you know, I like the classic stuff as well, but I do like a lot of the more titillating stuff, I won't lie.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. When at the opening of your book, you make it clear that you'd been through so many guides and manuals and textbooks, really, to learn what you needed to learn, and it was written in a completely kind of foreign language. You could read it 3 or 4 times. I feel the same way, and still not get it. Was that the main inspiration behind writing this book for you?
It was a primary inspiration. I mean, you ever sit around long enough and be frustrated with something for so long, and then finally you actually move to do something about it yourself. You know, somebody should do something. We're like, why is this like this? And why is then it's finally like, you know what, damn it, I'm going to do it myself. And that was I think a lot of the text out there, one of the biggest obstacles, I think, to filmmaking is just learning the process. The knowledge is so spread out and so much of it is passed through, you know, almost oral tradition from, you know, you kind of have to be on the set and you learn a trick, you know, you learn a trick from a gaffer, and then you're on another set and you learn a different trick from, you know, a camera person, and there's all these little, you know, tricks and things that will avoid you a lot of time and hassle. And even after the thing that I discovered, there was a little, set me back a little bit, was that after film school, even if you go to a formal film school, and I went, you know, went to NYU, I graduated from there in 94, world-class film education, but really no institution can really teach you everything that you need to know before it's all said and done. And so much is left out. So what I wanted to try to do was capture some of those core things that I just didn't seem to find in a book, even though they were the simplest of things, like how to hook up a mixer. You know, just a little, it sounds like a simple thing. It's something done on every set, but I'll be damned if you go to the bookstore and you can find a whole bunch of tutorials on it anywhere, because I couldn't.
Yeah, and what you do find, it feels like you're building a rocket ship. It's written in such a foreign language. So tell me about the philosophy behind the title, which is Shut Up and Shoot.
Real simple. It's a lot of people say, right, what I want to try to do with the book, too, is add a little bit of element of inspiration for people, also to get over some of the obstacles. So many people are intimidated by filmmaking, as was I as a student and still am in many cases. But there's a lot of intimidation to filmmaking, and we sit around and we have excuses. Well, I didn't go to NYU, so I can't make a film, or I can't afford this kind of camera, so I can't make a film, or I don't know, I'm not as good as this, you know, this my buddy over here that's been making films for 2 years. I'm not as good as him. So, and it's like, you know what, at some point, just shut up, pick up the camera, go out and shoot. And even the same as what I was just saying a minute ago, even if you can't find the book with the right, you know, advice that you'd like in it, go out there and do it. You're going to learn. Maybe you're going to screw it up, but you go out there and do it again, and you're going to screw it up less, or you're going to screw it up in a different way. And so the idea is that stop making excuses. I've given you this book now. Here's the basic instructions. Now you are free to shut up and shoot.
Absolutely.
That's
and plus
beautiful.
You tend to learn more from doing. I know that a common critique about these film schools is they spend so much time on theory and not enough time on practical, hands-on knowledge.
Yeah, and I'm a rebel against that, because I was one of those people that sat in class and was just snoozing through the theory, and it wasn't all making sense. And my approach or my theory on it is that the theory, and students will be a lot more interested in the theory and all of these things that we're trying. Not to say that it's not important. Don't get me wrong at all on that, because I think it is important. However, in the beginning, I think it's more important to just start doing it and getting an appreciation for filmmaking. That theory starts to make a lot more sense when you've done a couple of dolly shots or attempted to do a couple of dolly shots yourself, and then you look at how great one was pulled off. Then you can really appreciate it and understand and ask the proper questions, and you'll be more equipped to go out and do a better level of work yourself, having had some foundation to relate to when they're talking about, you know, wide shots and long, you know, long staging, all that kind of stuff.
Well, I wanted to get your opinion on film schools, but obviously you're a graduate of the NYU Tisch School of the Arts.
Yep, I'm a little biased.
Yeah, and it's a place that you're involved in to this day. So do you think it's worth it in the long run, film schools, or do you think you should just put that money into your own film?
That's a million-dollar question, and it really depends on who you are. I think now, more so than ever, first of all, I'll say that film school is not necessary for anybody. You can learn the crafts by doing, but there are some distinct advantages to going to film school. So I'm not for or against it. I would say it's probably 50-50 amongst my colleagues, the people that did go to film school and people that didn't, and they're equally as successful and equally as happy. Mm-hmm. I can talk to you about the pros and cons, I think, of film school versus not. I'll tell you some of the big pros of film school are that you have access to equipment, number one.
Yeah.
You have access to crew members in the form of your fellow classmates in most cases. You also have access to instructors and technical advisors. So when you do hit those obstacles, you go right into school. Hey, Professor so-and-so, what's going on here? You go to the cage to the guy in the lighting. He can fix it up right away, which is not an option you have, you know, if you're self-learning.
Right.
So all of those things. And then the bigger thing from a career perspective is really those people that you come up with. And everybody always says, this is what I always tell the students at NYU, everybody says this business is all about who you know. Well, who the hell you think you're going to know when you get out of film school?
Yeah.
It's going to be all those people that have sweat and bled with you over the last 4 years. Those are your colleagues, and a lot of the successful people that have graduated from NYU and USC too, I suspect, are working with people that they went to school with. You know, some of the Spike Lee's DP early on with the same DP from film school, Monty Ross.
That's
you know, so those partnerships form as things go along. Now, as far as being self-taught, the advantages for that, to me, is that it's obviously it's way cheaper in some cases. For the same amount of money that you would spend to attend NYU for grad school for 4 years, you could literally make a feature film and learn a lot of what you'd learned, granted, the hard way. And your film is probably not going to be that great when it's said and done, but you will have gotten whatever, you know, you will have gotten $20,000 worth of education if you make a $20,000 feature. I seriously doubt it's going to go up and blow up anywhere, but you will have gotten that education and learned it firsthand, and I had a number of friends that did it that way, and, you know, none of them made any great, you know, amounts of money if they even came close to breaking even on that first feature,
That's
but
true.
They learned what they needed to know in their craft in a really concentrated amount of time and also in the hardest way possible.
Yeah, that's true.
The difference between having a swim instructor and me pushing you in a 20-foot section of the ocean, you know. So they both may work in the end, but, you know, drawbacks.
Yeah, we've got a caller on 512 area code. I think this is a listener calling in. Let me take it real quick. Let me see if this is a question. 512 area code, go right ahead.
What's going on, fellas? This is Maxie D. Collier giving a call and a props to you all for producing your show on a you know, frequency that you're doing because it's a lot of work. I respect that. And big up to my man, Anthony Artist, because I was there in 1997 when he put that VX1000 camera in my hand. And then 2 years later, when I say, Anthony, we need a crew for Paper Chasers, he was there. So I just got to call and give some props.
Thank you, man. We appreciate it.
Oh, that's great. This gentleman on the phone, I didn't even know this gentleman was going to call in. This is actually one of the directors I was telling you about that is self-taught, Maxie Collier, who is actually, I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but Maxie Collier was the first feature that I worked on, was Maxie's feature as a location manager fresh out of school, like
wow.
Fresh out of NYU film school. I think I was like a month out of school.
That's right, a cold November in 1996. It was called Be More Hacks is the name of the movie. Shot on Super 16mm film because we were the last of the analog generation.
Wow.
So
this is what I mean by down and dirty. I started off on that film as a boom operator. I was hired on as a boom op. Great. It's a great position to just kind of, you know, feel my way through my first feature and see what it's like. And I don't know what happened somewhere along the way, but a week later I was asked to be location manager. But there's one thing Maxie forgot to tell me. They ain't have no locations. This was 2 days before shooting, mind you.
Yes, with the crew.
I was literally finding locations the day before we shot.
Wow.
With the cast of 51 spoken parts shot in 14 days on Super 16mm film. So, you know, we talk about down and dirty. We definitely are talking about going back in the critical time of understanding the transition from analog to digital, you know. And that's one of the things. So, Anthony, everyone keeps stealing my book, man. So, you know, I definitely got to get some more copies, man, down here in Austin because there's a lot of people, filmmakers, who are hungry for it down here.
Okay, well, you know where to put in the order.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm at WTV.com in case you're not sure.
And also, you guys can check out paperchasers.tv. You know, we ended up doing about 130 interviews. We caught Ludacris down in Atlanta before he got famous, and he let us follow him for about 3 years. You know, and Anthony was there for the bulk of those interviews, even our follow-up interview this past March with Damon Dash. So, pick up again.
Paper Chasers, is this available for purchase? Or repeat where they can find it online.
You can find it online at Amazon.com, Paper Chasers. Okay. It's also available. It shows on the Independent Film Channel on a regular basis for another year and a half. They're co-producers in it. It's aired on there about 8 times. And you can also find information on paperchasers.tv. And it's an underground classic, but we're now working on some regional editions, starting with the Texas edition of Paper Chasers DVD magazine.
Well, that's great, man. Keep on doing it. And if you ever want to be on the show, please let us know. We'd love to spend more time with you and talk to you more on the show.
Well absolutely. Keep rolling, T-Ski.
All right. Thanks, Max.
Thank you.
Peace out.
Bye-bye, man. That was nice. Now, I want to get into some of these highlights of your book very quickly.
Okay.
It's a phenomenal book, and every detail that you need to know, from lighting setups to, you know, color temperatures of lights, everything is in there. But I thought this was interesting when discussing content, that you say it's important to think about Rocky before you shoot.
Yes.
I thought this
Rocky
was interesting.
Before you shoot, meaning you got to train and prepare yourself. And really, what I say on that section, I say think Rocky before you shoot. Rocky is just stands for its acronym, stands for relevance, originality, and I forget what the other ones are right off the top. The K is for cash, I know, but the general idea is that you want to think through your project before you start shooting. A lot of times people will set out to do something that they really, you know, might be a little more than they can chew, or they just haven't thought it through enough so that when those first obstacles hit them, they're not prepared for it, and they end up giving up or shutting down their production or saying, no, I don't have enough money, whereas all of those problems could have been solved ahead of time by thinking a little more like Rocky during your training period, during pre-production, thinking it through about whether or not this is a viable project,
right,
and what all the obstacles are that could possibly stop you, and then how you're going to get through those obstacles. That's really a basic thought process that goes into any project I sit down, whether it's big or small. It's just, what's everything that can stop me? And now here's my weapon that I'm going to use when I come up against that, or here's how I'm going to walk around it. So that's really what I'm talking about in that section.
Well, in documentary filmmaking, I mean, the breadth of kind of the subjects that you can tackle in documentary filmmaking is just astounding. But do all great documentary subjects have something in common?
Do all great documentary subjects? Yeah, I want to watch them.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
About it.
That's you don't get better than that.
I would say, I mean, for me, it's just compelling, because really, I couldn't say that they have any one thing in common, at least not from my standpoint, because there's ones I like for different reasons. Some are experimental and totally different style. The only golden rule at the end of the day is, does somebody want to sit still in a chair and watch it?
Yeah.
If the audience starts losing interest, then I would say no. That would be the thing that they where you lose people somewhere along the line. So I'd say that's the only one thing across the line I'd say they have in common. The more common things found more often than not is really going to be a compelling character.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily in everything, because, you know, there's some things that aren't, you know, character centered. But I'd say compelling characters is probably the strongest thing across the board with any doc, you know, particularly with the character pieces. When we talk about movies like American Movie, mm-hmm. The Cruise, you've seen The Cruise about New York City tour guide.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
That are just totally centered around a compelling central character that just, you know, keeps you riveted to the screen across the board. So obviously that's probably one of the main ingredients to get a little more specific.
Yeah, and you're talking about doing your research earlier, research into the subject to make sure you have a grasp on it and if this is really something that's viable for a film. But it also determines everything from the budgeting on, doesn't it, the research that you do?
Oh, very much, very much. The research will let you know, like you said, whether or not you have a viable subject, but also help you think about and craft it. You know, a lot of times I'll approach things from, you know, my simple or common understanding, but then as you get deeper, you discover that there's a whole other side to something that you didn't even realize. You know, like maybe, what is that movie, The Devil's Playground? I'm not sure how it started, but it might have started with somebody like, oh, I'll do a nice little documentary about Amish people. And then they discovered that this whole other subculture of Amish youth and drugs and sex and rock and roll that's going on that nobody even knew or guessed about. So, you know, things can take a very different turn just by doing your research and learning as many details as you can beforehand. So,
yeah. And in terms of practicality of shooting it, crew, what is the minimum number of crew that you would recommend that a filmmaker must invest in? What are the positions that they should not do without?
Positions you should not do without. Wow. Well, I mean, you can go a minimum crew of one, and I do frequently if you're skilled enough to, you know, if you have the lighting, sound, and camera skills that you need, one is appropriate. I like to go with as few as possible, so I would say minimum for me is camera and director/sound, if that person is there working with you. But usually I would say camera,
mm-hmm.
audio, and then me as director and PA and filling in whatever else needs to go down. So a lot of times a three-person crew works out fine for me, maybe a fourth if you have a producer for something a little more formal, or there's a little more logistics to be worked out. It's good to have somebody else there to just deal with the logistics. Where are we going to eat lunch? How are we going to get there? Where's the petty cash? Who's going to take care of releases so I can focus on just the content along with the sound operator and the camera operator?
Yeah, and you're very clear, too, that a lot of mistakes that are made by beginning filmmakers deal with the sound, have to do with the sound. And you're very clear when you say that sound, in your opinion, is even more important than the picture.
Yeah, listen to this. Very clearly, your audio is more important than your video. I always like to say that loud and clear. I don't think enough filmmakers get it, and it's really sad to see because so many people, and I know I'm not alone in this, sabotage their own productions, particularly those early productions, because of the sound. I mean, the video is great. They got some compelling content. Somebody's on screen, and they're saying something great, but it's all garbled or it sounds like this, so I'm not really enjoying it at all, and I can't pay attention to it. And I had some early projects of my own in film school that were ruined that way that to this day still leave an ache in my heart every time I think about it. So people have to realize that your audience will forgive a blurry shot. They'll forgive a boom pole in the frame. They'll even let a bad performance slide for a few minutes. But nobody will sit through rumbly, overmodulated sound. Nobody will sit through loud, hissy sound. It's just too annoying. Even your own mama will get up and walk out of the room.
The last thing I want to touch on, interview subjects, dealing with interview subjects. I thought this chapter in your book was fascinating. Because you have a couple of things you have to deal with here. One is when a camera's pointed in someone's face, they automatically tense up.
Uh-huh.
And there's also the tendency to give you the simple canned responses that are less than genuine. And you have some tips to work out both of those.
A couple of things. I'll just run down a few of them really quick from the book. Number one thing is cover up that record, turn off that record beat on the camera. Tape over that light because those are just things that make people a little more obvious if they're being recorded. One common technique that people use a lot of times in documentary is sometimes, you know, you have the subject sitting there in the chair and you're just chit-chatting with them. You want to warm them up, just get them used to the fact that they're there with your crew and the lights are going to be on them. And a lot of times they'll start recording the interview without even telling them, meaning we've just been chit-chatting and we just kind of segue those chit-chat back-and-forth questions right into the interview. Mm-hmm. And somewhere about 2 or 3 minutes into the process, they'll ask you, hey, when are we going to start the interview? I'm like, hey, we started it 2 minutes ago. And it generally tends to relax them because It's like, you know, it's like when you're tensed up for a shot from the doctor and it's like, I already gave it to you. You're like, oh, that's not so bad. And they tend to relax more from there. As far as also handling subjects, a lot of times you want to make sure that they're looking good. One of the things that also makes people very self-conscious, even, you know, CEOs or whoever, is how they're going to be portrayed on video. People are always worried about how they're going to look. Are people going to see this big zit on my forehead, whatever. So there's techniques like makeup and lighting and tips that I give in the book for helping make people look a little more pleasing to video. And that tends to, believe it or not, that can go a long way to relaxing a lot of people. In most cases, if you know a little bit about video, you can make people look way better than they actually look when it comes right down to it. So that also helps relax subjects. What was the other half of the question? You asked me about another thing that I wanted to make sure I touched on about preparing subjects.
The kind of canned responses.
Right. You want to keep in mind that your subject is feeding off of you. Just like in this interview, we're going back and forth that you guys sound like this and I'm going to sound like this. If you're pumped up and excited, then I'm going to be pumped up and excited. So
right.
If you're not getting what you need out of your subject, then you want to first make sure you're responding to them. So responding means giving them verbal and nonverbal feedback. So you want to be nodding, smiling if it's appropriate. You know, if they're telling you a sad story, then you want to be looking sad or shaking your head in disgust or whatever. But and I'm not saying be phony, but I'm saying to make sure that you're expressing your response to the actual story that they're telling. The biggest thing that I think a lot of newbie documentary makers don't do is listen to their subjects. They go in with this list of 10, 12 questions, and they just ask these questions like rote. And meanwhile, the subjects are given some great, compelling answer, and your audience is dying for you to follow up, but you were just so, you know, so nervous or so zoned out that you didn't hear this little tidbit that they just gave you.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the line, it's like, oh, you were in prison when you were six? That's a relevant thing to know. And if you didn't catch that in your research and somebody threw that out there, that's the kind of thing you have to follow up and go back to. So listening to your subjects and amplifying your answers. So if somebody's not giving you a little bit of lackluster response, you can kind of challenge them and go back and be like, you know, get out of here. Like, that really happened? I don't believe you. And then I'm like, oh, yes, it did too. And they'll come back stronger. And so a lot of little techniques like that. But the biggest thing to remember is that an interview is just a conversation. Think of it no different than, you know, a first date at a party or you're trying to impress somebody, anything like that. It's just a conversation between two people. And the more you've done your homework and know about that person, the better conversation that you can have.
That's right. Phenomenal book. It's from Focal Press. It's called the Shut Up and Shoot documentary guide. This is a little mini empire you've been building with this Down and Dirty DV enterprise.
I'm trying. This is a new. Well, basically, I realized a few years back that being a guerrilla filmmaker ain't exactly going to pay all the bills I'd like to get paid before
right.
So, wanted to find a way to combine. Like, I really like to help people and I like to work with people. And I've been doing this for a long time, long before there was this book. Any young filmmaker that's pulled me up got an earful.
Yeah.
They'd have to run away from me before it was said and done. That's all I want to know, Anthony. That's plenty. Thank you. So
they can find this at bookstores, and they can also find more information on Down and Dirty DV and everything else you offer at downanddirtydv.com.
Yep, downanddirtydv.com, A-N-D. And if they get it from downanddirtydv.com, actually the book is 20% off there on downanddirtydv.com. And also I benefit considerably more from those sales, even though it ends in Barnes & Noble and everywhere else. So please go to downanddirtydv.com, order it. Also have a podcast on iTunes, the Down and Dirty DV podcast, which is coming out periodically right now since I've been working on the book, but next one's coming out in the next week or so. So check that out. Blog as well with a lot of free tips on it, all on low-budget filmmaking.
Well, I encourage everyone to visit your website and check out the book, certainly. And thank you so much for being with us tonight, Anthony. I can't thank you enough.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and I love the work you guys are doing. And hopefully, are you guys going to be down at Slam Dance?
We'd like to be. I'd love to be.
Well, if I don't catch you there this year, then hopefully another time.
Okay. We will look you up, man. Thank you so much.
Me up.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Take care, guys.
That's Anthony Artis. The book is called The Set Up and Shoot Documentary Guide. You don't look okay over there, Jerry?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. I mean, I told you. I said, like, my mouth is on fire, so...
Okay, one of our next guests is called in. We're waiting for the other two to show up on the line. How are things in the chat room? I know there's a conversation going back and forth about documentary.
Yeah, there's that documentary now. One of them, I think it's Ryan, lives next to the actual stars of American movie.
Really?
And they live in the same area, so he sees them, and that's something. If you've ever seen that movie, that's like definitely one of the best documentaries about movies.
Oh yeah,
definitely.
I'm crazy about documentaries. Do you have a favorite documentary?
I have a couple. Like, well, American Movie would be one, but actually the Bukowski Born Into This I like a lot, and I like The Fog of War a lot.
Oh, yeah, Fog of War. There was a movie, and they made a sequel to it too, a documentary years ago. Why can't I remember the name of it? It's they claim that the kids were inspired by rock and roll music or something. And
Paradise Lost.
Yes, Paradise Lost.
And then Paradise Lost 2. Yeah, they're very, very good.
Very good. And because you just get the sense of life and a mystery unfolding before your eyes. And that's what documentaries are greatest at. I mean, it's a fascinating life or a series of circumstances just unfolding, unforced, you know, they're just occurring.
Right.
Documentary, it's a great art form, and I think that certainly the digital technology has made it a lot easier for a lot of amateur documentarians to get their, you know, to find their way. And
oh, yeah.
Get their place.
Yes, that's very
seen.
True.
Okay, we have two callers on the line, so let's go ahead and... let's go ahead and introduce these guests, and hopefully the third one will pop up by the end of my introduction. You guys ready? I know a lot of people out there are excited about this particular segment, and we are too. Jack Ketchum is a widely read and highly revered horror novelist whose books include Red, Hide and Seek, and Offspring. Now, director Gregory Wilson and screenwriters Daniel Ferens and Philip Nutman have successfully adapted one of Ketchum's most brutally terrifying and controversial works for the screen. The Girl Next Door tells the story of the unspeakable abuse suffered by a teenage girl under the sadistic care of her adult guardian and a group of children who become complicit in the crime. The film, which celebrates its DVD premiere this Tuesday, December 4th, has been met by heaps of praise by high-profile figures from the horror genre, including author Stephen King, who calls it the first authentically shocking American film I've seen since Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer over 20 years ago. We are very pleased to welcome to the show director Gregory Wilson and screenwriters Philip Nutman and Daniel Ferens to our program. And I have two of them here. Let's see which two I have. Mr. Nutman?
Yep, you've got me. This is Philip. This is Phil to his friends, and we're all friends here. So it's great to have us. Thank you.
Thank you. And who do I have on the other line? Is this Mr. Ferens?
Yes, it is.
It is Mr. Ferens?
Yeah, this is Dan Ferens.
Hi, it's great to have both of you with us tonight. I'm excited to talk to you guys about this film. Whose lap did this fall into initially? Where did the seeds of this project start from?
Dan made a phone call to me, and Dan, you can explain it from there.
Okay. I had been working with Phil, who's a wonderful novelist, and we were talking about doing a film adaptation of his book, Wet Work, many years back. And one evening I received an email, or I was looking up something online, or some information came to me. I don't remember exactly how it came across my desk, but somebody had mentioned this book called The Girl Next Door, written by Jack Ketchum, and it proceeded to explain to me how this is probably the most disturbing, gut-wrenching book ever written, and it's something you should read, but, you know, if you're brave enough to tackle something like this. And I just happened to be on the phone with Phil that evening, and I said, have you ever heard of this book? I think it was a Friday night, and I called him and I said, you know, have you heard of this book, The Girl Next Door? And he said, yes. And I said, well, what do you know about it? And he's like, well, I know a few things. Not only did he know the author very well on a very personal level, but he had also just had recently, right, Phil, I had written the afterword to a special edition hardcover.
That was a couple of years previously.
Before.
Yeah, the book was originally published in, what, 1986, I want to say.
Was it 86?
No, I think it was 86.
Okay.
And suffered from an absolutely dreadful cover, thanks to Warner Books, which pretty much killed the book. But it developed a cult reputation, and then 10 years later, it was in, I believe it was the fall of 96, I was contacted by David Hinchberger at Overlook Connection Press here in Georgia, who I'd known for many years, and he was just starting up. He's a bookseller primarily, and had decided to do his own imprint and get into small publishing, and wanted to do a special limited edition, and the first one he decided to do was The Girl Next Door. And because he's had a long-standing relationship with Stephen King, and I had recently introduced Dallas Mayer, a.k.a. Jack Ketchum, to Stephen, and they had hit it off, Stephen offered to write a wonderful introduction to the limited edition, and Dave wanted me to do one of the afterwards for this special edition, which has been out of print for a long time. So I'd already read the book once. In fact, I'd read it the second time. I was so impressed with it, even though it's a tough book to read, but very beautifully written, which is why you can't put it down. And then so Jan asked me about this, and I'm like, oh, no, I got to read the book again.
and I did. I think my reaction was, well, first, Phil's advice, and I think, Phil, you were the one who got me the copy of it through the Overlook Press, and I read it in one sitting, and literally, like, I think most people who have the experience of reading this book, just it's one of those things you can't put down, not only because it's so wonderfully written and the characters are so well realized, but you have just a connection to the story, and it's and Phil and I have talked about this many times, but I think it's, you have to liken it to a train wreck or a car accident that you see on the freeway. It's, you know you shouldn't, and yet, you know, you
just can't look away.
It's going to happen.
Right.
I mean, I think it's just, it's human drama, and it's, you know, at its darkest, but it's one of those things you just can't look away from, and you need to know how this is going to turn out. And
yeah, and that's absolutely something that I wanted to know from you guys. And,
mm-hmm.
and in interviews with Mr. Ketchum, and he's made it clear that he never thought this would be one of his books that would make a cinematic adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
it's just a difficult material.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to know thematically and what it was within the story that spoke to both of you. If both of you can speak to that, starting with you, Phil.
The undeniable power of the book is, and I'm very much drawn to coming-of-age stories, especially dark material like William Golding's Lord of the Thighs, which, of course, this novel's been equated with on a number of occasions. But aside from the fact that it's so vivid and so evocative of the late 50s, you know, and I wasn't around then, so... You know, it has to be evocative. I'm a child of the 60s. It's undeniably powerful. It's an incredible character piece. And, of course, my response to Dan was after we were wrapping up this initial conversation, he's like, do you think you can get me a copy of the book? And I said, yes. And he said, do you think it'll make a great movie? And I laughed, and I said, I think you need to read the book before I try and answer that question. And... the fact is, it's powerful, and to me, subtextually. And the same applies to the movie. Greg, our director, who will hopefully be joining us shortly, because this will be the first time that the two screenwriters and the director have ever been able to talk publicly in an interview situation. So
yeah,
fingers
we're
crossed.
Awaiting his call. I'm anxious to hear from him.
But anyway, so to in answer to your question, to me, the novel speaks about the powerlessness of children and about the way that adults can abuse their position of responsibility towards children as caregivers, as parents, as guardians. And, you know, I think there's a very important, I hate to use the word message because that always makes you sound like you're preaching, but I think there's a very important emotional social core to the book that a lot of people initially overlooked because they just went, oh my God, this book is so horrendous. And of course, we have to remember that the novel is actually inspired by a terrible true crime. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the grounding, the basis of the book itself is in reality. But, you know, this is a very personal book for Jack Ketchum. He wrote it shortly after the passing away of his mother, and it was basically him saying goodbye to his childhood in New Jersey.
Yeah, and you can feel that in the piece, too. I know that Stephen King claimed it plays almost like a much darker version of his Stand By Me. Because you were speaking of the rite of passage aspect
mm-hmm.
of it. The film isn't... I know that it's getting a lot of press, and I know that I feel like it's being misjudged in a way. I know it's getting raves all over, but it's psychologically unsettling, this film, but it's not bloody. It's not about carnage. But it's very disturbing and unsettling, which I find any film dealing with child abuse must be.
Mm-hmm.
But were you at all apprehensive about, because these projects take years, about living in that world for so long? Were you at all apprehensive about doing that, Daniel?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, you read something like this and it's so affecting. And, you know, it's one of the stories that, and I'm sure if you've read the book, and I think anybody who's listening out there who's read the book, I mean, it's a story that you carry with you. It's not one that you just sort of leave behind. And it stays with you for a long time, and it resonates, and it haunts you a little bit. And I think the prospect of when Phil and I optioned the book, and then and through Dallas and his agent, and we made the commitment to go ahead and do this adaptation purely on spec, in the hope that somebody would you know, step up to the plate and be as affected by this material as we were. I mean, we did. We thought long and hard about how to approach it, you know, without compromising the material, but also making it. You know, the book is written in first person, and you've got to give it a screen treatment, and you've got to figure out how this would translate without making it pure exploitation. And I think that's the fine line with this material, is that you've got to be very sensitive to the material, but also, and to the characters, but also very true to them. So I think there was that difficult line that we had to walk in terms of the adaptation. Luckily, so much material was already within the book, whether it was, you know, in the internal monologue of David, the main character, who is reliving this experience, you know, looking back on it from his adult point of view. So there were lots of cues in there and little clues that we had within the text to broaden it in terms of visually and scope. But, yeah, I mean, going down that road and living through that nightmare, I mean, not only did you it's one of those books I think you'd probably read once and never forget it,
right.
But in terms of approaching it as a screenplay and, luckily, I had a partner. We could kind of bear the brunt of this together.
So how did that work? The screenwriting collaboration. Did you work together or share pages with one another?
Yeah, it was interesting. Phil lives in Atlanta. I live in L.A. So the entire, I mean, this is talk about a, you know, newfangled and
you should have seen our phone bills.
The time I think we're probably billing per minute.
Thanks to email and the internet,
yeah.
We were able to work as if we were in the same office.
Mm-hmm.
And we literally worked every day for virtually 6 months on adapting this. We did a lot. Just coming back briefly to your other question, yes, we did do a lot of soul searching about do we actually really want to do this. We talked pretty intensely for a two-week period to discuss, well, how are we... Not only dramatically are we going to approach the material and how best are we going to adapt it and make it an authentic adaptation, you know, because there's the old adage that bad books make good movies and good books make bad movies. Well, obviously there are exceptions to that rule, but more often than not, you know, bad books do actually make pretty decent movies. Our dilemma was we had such a great book to work with, how do we do this justice? But first and foremost, there was the moral dilemma about how, you know, this material is dynamite. And it's one thing to read it, because obviously the experience of reading a novel is a very personal, intimate experience. It's between the reader and the text, you know. But once you translate that into the visual medium of film, even through a screenplay, which of course is just a blueprint for the finished film, you know, you're taking it to a much more dynamic and visceral level. And we were always deeply concerned about, you know, where do we draw the line here? You know, we didn't want to censor ourselves, but we did feel that we needed to, you know, there were a handful of scenes in the book that we just felt would be too overwhelming and too powerful in the film, in a film version, that, you know, you would cross the line into to exploitation, even if the director was turned out to be really sensitive to the material like Greg did. But, yeah, we literally worked pretty much 6 days a week, sometimes seven. I would, because of the time delay with me being in on the East Coast, I would write some pages in the morning. I would then email them to Dan, so he'd read them over breakfast. Then he'd go in and work on that particular sequence and rewrite it and get it back to me. And we worked pretty much from A to Z on the book. Dan did the actual first breakdown on the manuscript. He put a lot of work in for about 2 or 3 weeks. I was tied up with comic book deadlines at the time and couldn't really put the kind of energy into breaking the book down that we had hoped, but Dan stepped up to the plate and did a fabulous job. And then it was a process of whittling the book down and whittling it down till we had something resembling a skeleton that we could then rebuild up as a screenplay.
Right.
But yeah, it was 6 months.
Way, I remember a lot of, within the final draft or whatever it was at the time, scriptware software, we had like post-it notes and we'd say, this is what's missing here, and, you know, this worked in the book, but this didn't, this won't work on screen. And so it was a lot of just kind of figuring it out, and it's weird. I think the beginning, especially when this Phil was just explaining how I kind of did the initial breakdown of the book and just finding the context for some of these scenes, and I remember having to be very detached from it and looking at it at that point just as mere text more than events and being a...
You couldn't get too emotionally engaged with the material.
Point,
it was too painful.
It was mechanical at that point and just trying to figure out what you could use and then what you couldn't. But then as we got personally more invested in as the story started taking shape, I do remember many times having to kind of stop and give myself, okay, I'm going to get to this point in it, but I'm not going to go any further because it's too much to take. And I remember watching a lot of comedies around the time that we were writing this. I just remember putting on old I Love Lucy episodes and just anything to make me giggle because I needed that levity to sort of break away from the pain and suffering.
I could imagine.
Yeah, and it wasn't easy. I mean, I'm not to say that, you know, to get too heady about the whole thing, but really it was a painful experience. I remember Phil and I were kind of counseling each other along the way of like, oh my God, you know, can we do this? Can we go this far? Do we do this scene? Do we not? Do we, you know? And, you know, and we weren't even writing this, Phil. I mean, I remember we didn't have this, honestly, this day-to-day conscious thought of selling the script or thinking we're going to make a lot of money off of it, or there was never that idea. I think we just both felt very passionately about this story.
By the time we got into the process of writing it, it was the excitement, it was the challenge, certainly, I mean, I'd collaborated with other writers in the past, but we discovered very quickly in the process that this was one of the most intense and close collaborations that I certainly had ever had. I can't speak for Dan.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is that, you know, I would never have wanted to have adapted this book on my own.
No.
I think it really helped that we had a synergy there, we had a shared vision, we both cared very, very strongly about the characters, we cared about the original text, and as Dan said, you know, there were times when we were, you know, a lot of what we discussed on the phone was not so much the physical mechanics of our collaboration process and what was going in the script, but it was basically just keeping each other's spirits up. Because,
right. Yeah.
You know, 6 months
yeah,
of dealing with this
material.
Yeah,
and it was just, and you, and sort of looking at the ongoing, you know, that just as this thing descends further and further and further into the almost unbelievable realm that it goes to.
Yeah.
You just find yourself doing whatever you can to kind of step away from it a little bit. Like I said, I watch a lot of movies and shows, and you know, just trying to kind of keep the mood around me a little lighter.
Yeah,
and when you go back into that world, even if it's just two pages of it or three or whatever you're working on that day.
Phil, you said that you've known Ketchum, that you have personal relationship with Ketchum before this project came about.
Mm-hmm.
What is his view on humanity, would you say?
Idiots piss him off really badly. he which is actually a direct quote. He is very I think he and I share a similar attitude, and this is like my favorite Charlie Brown Peanuts cartoon, where it's like one of those little four-panel strips where little Charlie with his stumpy arms is standing on the pitcher's mound with his pitcher's glove and doesn't say anything. And then in the fourth panel, he's got this completely perplexed expression on his face where he says, "I love humanity, it's mankind I can't stand."
Yeah,
and I think that's pretty much something personal for me, and I feel that's pretty much the same for Jack Ketchum as well. He's a devoted animal lover. He has four wonderful cats. He's very passionate about animal rights issues and animals being treated. And you know, when you get to know him as a person, considering the fact he's got this reputation for writing these incredibly brutal and relentless novels that explore the darkest areas of human nature, the fact is he's a very gentle soul, very easygoing, and
very funny. I have to add that he makes me laugh.
Oh, Dallas is a good. He's got a great sense of humor.
Yeah.
But yeah, his what motivates him to write about these subjects is that he gets pissed off. He gets angry. And the fact is that the original case that inspired The Girl Next Door, the Sylvia Likens Gertrude Banaszewski case, mm-hmm. which actually took place in Indiana in the early 60s, he's a big reader of true crime fiction and has been for many, many years, even before true crime books became really popular and became a publishing phenomenon. He had been studying true crime for a long time. And, you know, he'd come across a number of cases over the years that had just infuriated him and maddened him to such a degree that this was working into his fiction. And with the case of The Girl Next Door, he stated repeatedly on record, the fact is that, you know, he had been haunted by this case for so many years, but he'd never been able to feel that he could adequately write about it because, A, you know, he's from New Jersey, admits, "I know nothing about the Midwest," and he didn't feel comfortable about writing about the early 60s. But when, you know, as I said, his mother passed away, he was in New Jersey cleaning out the old family house and was finding all these comic books and things from his own teenage years in the 50s, and that's when it suddenly hit, and he decided, if I transpose this to 1958 in New Jersey, I think I can write about it.
Yeah.
But his motivation primarily comes from anger and from a sense of moral righteousness, although he's never one to ever preach. And when you first read The Girl Next Door, the novel, especially the wonderful opening where adult David Moran has the great opening line, "You think you know about pain,"
mm-hmm.
and with what unfolds in the book, as you're reading the book, you're thinking, what exactly is the author's moral viewpoint on this, you know? And that's what I think makes his work so interesting.
Well, do you think that this kind of behavior, I mean, this is extreme behavior, honestly, obviously, but the children's parents die and they're placed in the custody of their adult guardian. Was this an aunt they're placed in the custody of?
Yeah, a distant aunt, at least the fictional version. In the true story, it's, you know, the facts are different, and I don't want to anybody who's going to see the movie to go into it thinking this is a reenactment
is not a docudrama.
Right.
It's not at all. Things are very, very similar. I mean, Ketchum in the book and Greg and all of us involved in the film, we didn't go too far astray from the incidents that occurred. And as to sort of continue what Phil was saying, in terms of Ketchum's point of view and his sort of, is this a morality play? And I think it very much is. I think without adding this character of David, in the true story, the David character who we meet as an adult at the beginning and then we flash back into his childhood, and he becomes kind of the eyes of the story, and I think the viewpoint of the audience in the book and the film.
Yeah.
And I think Daniel Munchie, who plays the role of David, the young David in this movie, is outstanding, and I think he's one to watch.
Yeah. There are outstanding talents in this cast.
Oh, good.
That I definitely want to talk to you about. But
yeah.
I was wondering about what you view as the Guardian's motivation. Does it speak to the ongoing cycle of abuse and violence?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Most definitely. I mean, I think most children can relate to that feeling, as Phil was saying earlier, of helplessness, of not really having a voice, or feeling that you're just part of a system that you can't control and don't at that age even understand. You know, I think a lot of what drives children is fear of getting in trouble, fear of being disciplined, fear of, the kind of adult world that we live in where you always feel that there's that your voice isn't heard, or that you're not in any way being taken seriously. And I think this is just a cautionary tale in a sense. You know, again, I don't think Ketchum goes out of his way to preach in any moral way, but I do think there's a morality to the story. I certainly wouldn't have invested myself in the story, and I don't think Phil would have either, if there wasn't a character to sort of see through. There was no real, what I was going to say is that there was no David in the true story. There was no, person on the outside looking at these events and seeing this unfold. There was no childhood crush. There was none of that sort of unrequited love story that appears.
David's a complete fictional construct.
He's a completely fictional character. So in a way, the true story is just even more heartrending, and knowing that this poor girl went through all
actually, the events of the true story, of the true case, are worse than anything in the
much
book.
Much worse. Much worse. I mean, if you can only imagine. But
well, I think we have a caller.
Oh, cool.
It might be Gregory, or it might be a caller. So I'm
going
to open up this
fingers
line.
Fingers crossed.
It is a 201 area code. 201, go right
ahead. That's Greg.
Hey, it's me.
Greg, how are you?
Good. Sorry, gentlemen. I was in a bad area, and I could not make the call, so I apologize for coming in. It looks like I came in at the very tail end here.
Oh, no, that's fine. That's fine. We've got plenty of time. Gregory, let's talk about casting with you. We've been talking about the girl next door thematically and how it was brought to life through their adaptation. But talk to me about what you saw in the material when it came your way, what you thought you could do with it.
Well, the material obviously was very powerful and very well written from the genesis of the book into the translation of the screenplay. And, it was, the first read for me, was obviously very difficult, because I always felt that that to me the story itself, I mean, particularly with David, didn't have redeeming values. And for me, the one major reason that I wanted to do this project was because it was based on the true story, obviously based on the novel, which was based on the actual event. And that was really my attraction to it. I mean, this is something that, it was just a very powerful story.
Yeah, and the children in this film, we're just bringing this up a little bit ago, are just phenomenal. How important was the casting of this film, not only in terms of finding the right talent, but kind of navigating their capacity to handle this kind of material?
Well, the casting was crucial, because you needed to find actors that were obviously mature enough to handle the material, and also you needed, in addition to the casting of the actual talent of the actual children, you also needed to, as I always say, you needed to cast the parents. The parents were, a very integral part of the process, because they need to be informed of, obviously what their children are getting ready to play and what they're getting ready to see and so on. So there was definitely, a two-part element to the whole casting. First, finding the right actors, and then making sure that the parents understood what the process was. And we were very fortunate to find the actors that we did.
Yeah, and in terms of actually shooting these really difficult scenes, I would think they would have to be very sensitive with. A lot of times they weren't even able to be involved in the actual action of some of these scenes, right?
Correct. There was some scenes I actually had to just verbally talk them through emotions, not necessarily actions. Because, for example, the best example would be the rape scene where you see the Meg is being raped by the Ruth's oldest son. For the reaction shots, I basically just talk them through certain emotions. You're seeing, you know, give me something that, you know, something disgusting, something, you know, and really just talking to them emotionally, not necessarily telling them that they're watching a rape, because at their age they don't, that's not in their vocabulary. They wouldn't understand it. They could hear the word, but not process the action.
Right.
So that was one of the things that I had to do, was just which actually made me feel more comfortable, because at the end of the day, while we wanted to serve the story, it was also important that we protect our actors.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to get your take.
Just one comment in regard to that. Not only was Greg so serene on set and so calm and reassuring to the kids, coming back to talking about the actors, the young actors' parents, I was on set one of the days when we had all of the kids there, and the parents were all sitting around off camera, having their own kind of little coffee clatch, and I got to talk to all of them, and they all were very, very thoughtful and very responsive to the material. They all went out and read the book. They researched the Likens case. They really made a point of understanding what this movie was about. Not that it was just an opportunity to put their kids in a potentially sensationalistic movie.
Yeah.
So we were very, very fortunate there that, you know, not only did we have an incredibly talented cast of kids to work with, but, you know, we had the moral and responsible guidance and support of the parents.
Yes. And this is something, forgive me if this is a question that doesn't make a lot of sense, but when you're making a movie, Greg, about child exploitation in a way, this is one of the themes that this film deals with. How do you keep from having your film fall into the realm of being exploitation itself?
Well, my response has always been, when people only see the exploitative elements of the film, then I always say, then you missed a major part of the story. Because one of the things, as I mentioned before, is that the one reason to tell this type of story is because it is factually based. Obviously, you know, the artistic license was taken from Jack on down to all the writers. But because I've received that question many times, and I, you know, for me, this type of story, it's about the formula. Oftentimes, we hear about child abuse. You know, the one case I think of here in New York in recent months or years was the Mixed Mary Brown case, where she was also killed at the hands of her parents. One was a step-parent, you know, people who were supposed to love her and protect her. You only hear the aftermath. You only hear the end result. You never hear the equation. So for me, the telling of this story was about developing the equation. Now, can someone just lift those particular scenes at the very end, or in the second and third act? They could, and then charge us with exploitation. But I honestly do not believe it was exploitative. I think
I don't think that it's exploitation either. I think you completely avoided that, and I think it's an incredibly visceral experience, your film, and very disturbing, and it stays with you. I mean, I watched it a few nights ago, and I haven't been able to shake it. And which is good, because that's the kind of movie that this screams out to be.
I think that's what we always intended, if I may chime in. And I think Greg, again, did a great job of eliciting those performances without, again, putting those children in any kind of dangerous situation or anything damaging to them, certainly physically or psychologically. But I think there's a real power in this. I think, and Greg, you touched on it in terms of the second act, where it gets very dark. It's really the second half of the movie that becomes, you know, that point of no return, that staring into the abyss that Stephen King wrote about for us. And but I think really that the first half of the movie, we all of us consciously made an effort to, and again, this is also credit to the book, because we had great source material, but I think you really become invested in these characters in the first half.
Yeah.
And I think without that, I mean, I think that's where you would, if we had this movie, you know, in the realm of a hostel, where you start off with, you know, these scenes of horror and torture, I think it was really important. Character was everything. And I think it was always important for us as the writers to track the psychology of these characters from the beginning, and to know where they start and to know where they're going to end up, and to really follow them on this journey. And I think that was what made the difference here in terms of making it a piece of dramatic cinema as opposed to just a straight up exploitation horror film.
I agree. And I've been seeing these descriptions of the exploitative nature, but that doesn't apply to this film at all. And like I said earlier, this isn't your typical film that's about blood and carnage and all of that. It's not like that at all.
No. And you know, for me, you know, the question always comes up about the horror element. And I always said, I've always made it very clear that from my point of view as the director, that my approach on this film was not, I never saw this film as a horror film in the traditional sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is a social horror. It is clearly horrific, and there are clearly elements and events that happen that you could definitely call it horror. But for me, it was always just a very, very dark drama. And I tried to do that with that sensitivity in mind. I mean, there was always, for me, four major themes that I will keep going back to. You know, because I mean, when you have the book and you have the script, everything, you have so much material to work with. I always worked with the themes of basically this is a coming of age story, because you have young children, young adults coming of age, dealing with adult themes of sexuality and violence.
Yeah.
You have the unfulfilled love story between a blossoming love story between David and Meg. And then you have, obviously, what happens in the basement. And then another element, which is smaller but crucial, was the bookends, in the sense that older David, how the events affected his life and affected his marriages and really scarred him psychologically.
Yeah. The film is out Tuesday on DVD. It is an incredibly effective film. I want to know what's next for all of you guys. Gregory, what you got on your plate next?
Well, next, we are currently developing a film that we're going to shoot in China, because there's also a human interest story. It's sort of a real estate type of film dealing with the problems that China has right now. I guess it's the population of 1.1 billion people, and they're going through this renaissance with all these Western companies that are coming into China and setting up factories and so on. So we're dealing with the next story that we want to tell is a story about these two brothers that are on the opposite sides of morality with respect to these scams that are going on in China, where the government and corporations are basically stealing land from the people, from the common people, and almost like an eminent domain policy. So it's another powerful story, so hopefully we'll be shooting that sometime late next year.
So you're in pre-production on that right now?
Yeah, we're actually developing. We already have a script, and we're just actually going through rewrites and changes now.
Great. Phil, how about you?
I'm actually in the middle of adapting another Ketchum project.
Great.
Which I wasn't anticipating doing, but some other filmmakers came to me and said, you know, we're so excited about what you guys did with The Girl. We'd love to work with you. There's this project, The Crossings, which is a Western novella that came out a couple of years ago. And it was one of Ketchum's pieces that I actually hadn't read. He's been so prolific over the last few years, even though we're good friends. I have a hard time keeping up with all the books, my friends, right? And anyway, by the time I finished page one, I just fell in love with it. My first love, genre-wise, movie-wise, as a little kid, was Westerns. Mm-hmm. And seeing the opportunity to do a very dark, again, it's got horrific elements, but I'm not considering it a horror Western per se. That has a whole other connotation to me. So I've been pitching it as a noir Western. I call it The Outlaw Josie Wales Goes to Hell.
That's great.
And so I'm in the middle of adapting that right now. And if all goes to plan, in addition to also producing it with director, writer, producer Gary Sherman, who did Deathline, a.k.a. Raw Meat, and Poltergeist 3, and Dead and Buried, we're looking at me directing this.
Well, that would be great. I mean, you had my ticket sold when you said Outlaw Josie Wells Goes to Hell.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. We'll be at the premiere.
Daniel, how about you?
I just walk a picket line right at the moment. the Writers Guild of America is currently on strike.
Right.
And, it's rather quiet here in town. But other than that, just prior to the strike, we finished filming a supernatural thriller starring Virginia Madsen called The Hunting in Connecticut for Lionsgate.
I've heard of that one.
Yeah.
This
looks fantastic.
Yeah. So we're very excited about it. It will come out next year. We think in the summer, but it might be in the fall. But we just wrapped production on that, so that's very exciting.
Well, please come back and join us when that film comes out. We'd love to get the scoop on that one.
Most certainly, I'd love to.
And thank you all for joining us
tonight and
talking about The Girl Next Door. And you guys are more than welcome to come on anytime you'd like, and I appreciate your time tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
Thank you, guys. Bye-bye now.
Yeah.
That is director Gregory Wilson and screenwriters Philip Nutman and Daniel Ferens. The Girl Next Door comes out on DVD Tuesday. Okay, Jerry.
All right.
How did that go?
I think that went very well.
And how's the chat room going?
It's going good. I think they actually got it's really funny. They answered the questions, that some of our chat room listeners asked, but we didn't get. There's one that I wanted to get. We didn't get to. A guy just wanted to know about Phil's wet work, what the progress was at on that project, but we didn't get to that.
Well, I think that it's probably been postponed with his work on the new Ketchum book. Didn't he say something about wet work earlier?
Yeah, he did. I didn't remember that either, because I heard it, because when the gentleman in here brought that up, I was like, yeah, that name sounds familiar.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, guest number...
it's been a very lively chat room tonight, so...
That's good. We appreciate everyone joining us tonight. We're going to bring on Arenada Diaz right now, our home video guru. And we're going to talk about a couple of the new video releases, DVD releases. Video's like antiquated now. What am I talking about? Aaron.
Hello. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up?
I don't know
about you, but Outlaw Josie Wales goes to hell. I didn't know Outlaw Josie Wales could get any bleaker.
If he's in hell, he could.
So I'm intrigued.
Mm. Yeah.
So that is one of Clint Eastwood's best films.
So we got a couple of movies to discuss before our show closes tonight.
Right.
A couple of new DVD releases you've given a look to. Tell me about them.
All right. Well, we're going to cover the spectrum here in that I'll do the mainstream title first, and that is Paramount's recent release of Andy Sandberg's Hot Rod, which came out in August. Kind of like when... anything that opened on the weekend of Star Wars, probably got crushed, and same thing, how do you follow the Beatles on Ed Sullivan?
Right.
Hot Rod had the misfortune of coming on right before Superbad, so it pretty much got kind of squashed.
Yeah.
But the surprise of the film is that it's actually has some big laughs in it, and it's actually a good little comedy, and it's a Saturday Night Live comedy. Lorne Michaels produced, so the bar is not set very high on those types of comedies, and so Hot Rod is actually one of the better ones.
It's a step above a lot of the recent Saturday Night Live ones.
I mean, it really is. There is what I like. I was not a Napoleon Dynamite fan. I just thought it was very cloying and mannered and so forth, but it was a big hit. And the thing about Hot Rod, it has some of those Napoleon Dynamite touches and ironic humor, but for some reason there's a certain sweetness and lightness of touch that somehow it doesn't seem as cloying.
Right.
And some of these gags are really, really, really funny. And Bill Hader, who was Napoleon Dynamite, I think he's improved as an actor, and so he's funnier here as part of Andy Sandberg's crew versus being the lead. And it's a very funny film, and there's just some inspired casting. I guess the plot of the film, if you want to call it a plot, is that Andy Sandberg plays he's a stuntman because he believes his father his father was a stuntman and died in a terrible accident, and he wants to live up to his father's legacy, and he wants to be a stuntman. The problem is he, instead of using a motorcycle like Evel Knievel, he uses basically a moped, and you would think that gag would get kind of tired, but they do enough variations on it that it remains funny. And meanwhile, his mother, cast as Sissy Spacek, cast as his mother, and has remarried to Ian McShane from Deadwood. And And there's this bizarre, very funny, surprisingly touching subplot of Andy Samberg's Hot Rod trying to earn his stepfather's love and respect by beating him up. And that gag, on-running gag, it never gets tired. It's just funny the way they keep trying to fight each other. And I guess the most famous scene already of the film is the parody, homage, spoof of Footloose, the Kevin Bacon warehouse dance sequence. And it is one of the funniest things I've seen all year. It's just a hilarious spoof.
So it's a movie that a lot of people didn't give a chance in the theaters, but they should definitely check it out on a rental.
Yeah,
perfect
I
for DVD.
Yeah, it does work, and it is funny. I will say about the Footloose parody, I think another film that it is referencing that only the truly obscure people will know is that it's also referencing Albert Magnoli's American Anthem. I don't know if anyone remembers American Anthem.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of working out in the woods type sequences in American Anthem that I'm almost certain they're spoofing here also. But no, like I said, it was funny. I think the real key to the film's success is actually the screenplay by Pam Brady, who, when I did some research, she'd written for South Park and Team America and a bunch of other very, you know, top-end comedies. And so I think that's probably one of the keys to the film's success.
Any extras on this disc?
Oh, well, like a lot of comedies, there's the commentaries, and they're very funny. You know, just they're not really commentary. They're just kind of chances to kind of goof along to the film. And they're very good. And, of course, you got deleted scenes and bloopers. And surprisingly, a decent amount of them are actually kind of funny. So they're not all superfluous.
Yeah.
And I just looking at my notes, this Pam Brady screenplay, you know, not only did she write for South Park and Team America, but she also wrote on The Loop, which is a great lost sitcom. She also you'll like this, Jamie. She wrote for Kid Notorious, the Robert Evans cartoon.
Oh, really?
And she's writing a screenplay for the Dallas movie. So that tells me that the Dallas movie is going to be kind of a more of a
tongue in cheek,
and that's probably the best way to go with a
Dallas
movie.
Yeah, I think
movie.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. We have somebody in the chat room that wants to know. We talked about No Country for Old Men and Cormac McCarthy last week, but what do we think about Ridley Scott's adaptation of McCarthy's other novel, Blood Meridian? We talked about Ridley Scott last week as well.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about the material. Have you read Blood Meridian?
I haven't read Blood Meridian, but I hear it's very good, and I hear that actually Ridley Scott is a very good choice for this project.
Yeah.
I've only heard good things about it. I mean, someone told me about this a couple of weeks ago.
Is that
I gotta say, I see no problem with it.
Aaron, what about you?
Well, is that Ridley's next film, or is that after Nottingham?
I don't know.
Probably after Nottingham. I think Nottingham is going to go right after Russell Crowe finishes this one movie he just signed on for.
Yeah, well, he's doing that DiCaprio CIA film.
Yeah, so.
Back to home video.
Okay, so McCarthy should be interesting. Ridley Scott and McCarthy should be interesting, though.
Yeah.
But so that's the mainstream title, and I would recommend Hot Rod. It is a good rental, and like I said, it's not super bad, but it is actually a funny film. So I was quite surprised.
Okay, a couple of minutes left. Let's talk about the art film of the week.
Well, the art film of the week is, and it's been out for a couple of weeks, is Milestone Home Video, massive production of I Am Cuba. And this is one of these films that a lot of us movie geeks, we always hear about or we read about or hear that, you know, that you saw in film school and you just couldn't believe it, but it was a hard-to-find film. In Milestone, apparently they spent all year working on this three-disc production, and it's worth every penny. Just the packaging alone, it's one of the best packages I've seen ever. They package it in a cigar box.
Yeah.
All three discs are in a cigar box, and you get the movie, and you get a documentary on the director and a documentary on the making of the movie. And the story of I Am Cuba is almost of the making of I Am Cuba is almost as interesting as the movie, in that this was a joint Soviet Cuban production, and this was in the early 60s. 1964 is when the movie came out, and the production started in 62. And they wanted to a film made to it's basically propaganda for Castro and communism. And they hired screenwriters and directors to do this and to highlight the plight and how the Castro was going to fix everything and so forth. And so the film, of course, so they finished the film. They had all the resources at them. And then when the film was finished, they shelved it because for some reason they weren't happy with the final product. Because it is propaganda, but for some reason it wasn't propaganda enough.
Yeah.
But luckily the film wasn't destroyed, and in the early to mid-90s it got rediscovered in festivals, and it's one of those films it's one of those films where the visual style and just the pure filmmaking of it outweighs any of the film's message. And actually the film now plays with a overlay of irony and sadness because it is anti-American and it is propaganda, but now if you were to see it cold now, you see it as kind of wish fulfillment and how it just never came to be.
Mm.
And the film tells basically four stories, four little sections that illustrate certain parts of the Cuba at that time in the early 60s. And then we see the peasant uprising and we see the revolution come and it ends on a supposedly triumphant note, but it's actually very bittersweet. But the filmmaking is just spectacular, and the best extra, as packed as the DVD is, the best extra is probably on the film itself, where they have a 15-minute interview with Martin Scorsese, who presents the film along with Coppola. But Scorsese's the one to talk, and Scorsese is right when he says that this film had been seen when it was made. Who knows what the language of filmmaking would be? As it is now in the early to mid 90s, directors who have seen it have been influenced by it. The most obvious one is obviously there's a scene in I Am Cuba where it's an opening scene where it just shows the happiness and the good times of Cuba. There's a Cuban version of rock and roll, and there's a party on the roof, and the camera, and it's all one long take. The camera goes around this rooftop party, and it floats down to another floor, and it follows some another partygoer, and then it follows a woman from a table who goes into a pool, and it follows her in the pool, and then the pool gets filled with other swimmers. And obviously that scene, when you see it, you can see that Paul Thomas Anderson was obviously a big fan of the film. And there's a similar scene in the first party at Jack Horner's house, where the camera went from table to table and followed the woman into the pool. So
in Boogie Nights, yeah.
In Boogie Nights.
So it has a visual bravura to it. Would you compare it any way to, because we're talking about propaganda and being so visually powerful, to the Lenny Rosenthal's works?
The thing about the Riefenstahl films. Particularly, I don't know, that's a good question. I guess, obviously you can make it because obviously those films were for the same reason. Hitler commissioned, those were made to kind of bolster his cause. But even then, those films failed, particularly Olympiad, where, the whole thing was Hitler was trying to show off his super race, and then you get the whole Jesse Owens section of it. And Triumph, I think the more apt comparison would be Triumph of the Will.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know, for some reason the I Am Cuba is not, I guess it's not as dangerous as Triumph of the Will, if you want to use that word. I guess because we pretty much know how Castro's regime has turned out, while anti-Semitism and neo-Nazis are still with us. So I guess you could say the Triumph of the Will is probably still more volatile.
But still very controversial in that even given all of that controversy surrounding it, there's no doubt that she was a fantastic filmmaker.
Oh, that is absolutely true. The filmmaking itself of Leni Riefenstahl and then the filmmaking itself in I Am Cuba is just it's just remarkable. I mean, there is, like I said, I'd never seen I Am Cuba until I got this release, and there were at least three times where I rewound a sequence But I just wanted to see just what they did again. And you do that, you're just aghast, you know, you're just amazed at what they were able to do, and you don't know how they did it, you know, because it's nothing digital.
Right.
You know, and it's all, you know, obviously, unlike America, they're having to deal with, you know, what equipment they have, and it's just pretty, it's just a remarkable film.
So you would definitely recommend both. You know, they seem, they're polar
worlds apart.
Yeah, I recommend, but I Am Cuba, but like I said, I mean, real quick, I just want to give a shout-out to the director. His name is Mikhail Kalatozov. Kalatozov. I'm probably not pronouncing it correctly, but that is Mikhail Kalatozov, whose other film, by the way, is The Cranes Are Flying, which I believe is a Criterion film.
Is a Criterion, yes.
Yeah, The Cranes Are Flying. So he is a world-renowned filmmaker, but like the thing about I Am Cuba is just, it is a film, if you love film, it is a film not only do you have to see, but it should be in your collection. Like I said, just the packaging alone, it's just fun to look at. This cigar box you get in the mail, that I got in the mail, I just started smiling at just the sheer detail they went into it. And like I said, the filmmaking just overrides any kind of political objections you might have on the film.
Right.
And it's truly spectacular. It is one of the best films I've seen this year. It just happens to be a 1964 film.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I Am Cuba is just truly jaw-dropping. And I just want to give a special shout-out to Milestone Film, who do not put out a lot of titles. I mean, they put out titles, but unlike, you know, they don't seem to have the cachet of Criterion, the Criterion collection. But when they put out a title, they do go all out because they've done this, and then we talked
Killer of Sheep. Yeah.
Killer of Sheep.
And meaningful films that mean something to the history of the medium as well.
Right.
Yeah, they're very, not meaningful, I mean, they're important. They need to be preserved. Obviously, Killer of Sheep is going to forever be preserved, but I Am Cuba is just as vital a piece of filmmaking as anything that's out there.
And in terms of restoration of image, it's nice job.
Oh, it's jaw dropping. The sound. I mean, it's a mono soundtrack, but the restoration is just jaw dropping. I mean, from what I've gathered, this was you know years in the making, because you know.
Yeah. Yes, it was.
It was years in the making. In fact, the Ebert, I looked it up. His review of the film is from like 1996, I think, in like December '96, around there. So it's one of those films. So back then it was presented by Scorsese and Coppola. So that's 1996,
yeah.
And here it is 2007, and we finally get its first.
Last 3 minutes of the show, we have a caller, 574. We'll get to him real quick. 574, go right ahead. 574, are you there? Okay, 574. Okay. So we recommend both with particular recommendations on I Am Cuba.
Yeah.
For its place.
If you care about anything, if you even say you care about cinema, you owe it to yourself to rent or to buy I Am Cuba.
What is the retail price on I Am Cuba?
If I'm not mistaken, I believe it's 40. You know, $39.95. I believe it's 40.
Okay.
Yeah.
Three discs. So it's either 40 or 50.
All right.
So
all
it's
right.
Remarkable.
Everybody, join us Wednesday night. Actors Raymond Barry, Ben Chaplin. Director Jay Russell. It's going to be a great show.
Yes, it will.
Mm-hmm.
And Aaron, thanks for joining us and giving
thank
us
you, Aaron.
A scoop
no
on
problem.
The newest titles.
No problem.
And Jerry,
yes, thanks.
Thanks for manhandling the chat room.
Yeah.
And hope you get to feel it better.
Thank you. Thanks.
We will see everyone back here Wednesday night.
Okay. Good night, everyone.